Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, November 29th, 1978. Much of San Francisco is in shock. There have been a few days of riots and violence in the wake of the assassination of Harvey Milk 2 days earlier on November 27th. Milk was a 48-year-old San Francisco supervisor, the city's first acknowledged homosexual official. He was assassinated in the San Francisco City Hall building, shot 5 times by former city supervisor Dan White. Also shot and killed that day was San Francisco Mayor George Moscone. So here to talk about it with a little bit of a focus on Harvey Milk and his political work and his legacy and a lot of the other interesting ripple effects from this moment is, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Jody.
So people, I think, know the Harvey Milk story a little bit, certainly the death. There was a movie not that many years ago about Harvey Milk, and his legacy is seen as one of the most influential gay rights icons and political gay rights icons in the 20th century. But I was wondering if we could actually start a little bit with just painting a sketch of him as a local politician. I mean, what is your sense of what Harvey Milk was as a San Francisco supervisor?
You know, by the time he runs for office, he's a fairly liberal politician. He is promoting things like expanded childcare, free transportation, low-rent housing, civilian review boards, the kinds of things that you would expect from a Democratic politician in the 1970s. And notably, like, not a ton that he's saying on the front of gay rights.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you read about his work, and it looks like he kind of, like a lot of politicians who are working their way up, start incredibly local and then just sort of add layers to their political advocacy. And his identity as a gay person and gay rights issues didn't really come in until that later part of his career. But I think that's, you know, a reminder of probably why he was so beloved, is he cared about his local community. I kind of thought of him as like a Jane Jacobs type as I was reading, you know, someone who just really cared about and really believed in communities and shared spaces and improving that. And, you know, a lot of the politicians we've talked about, like Paul Wellstone comes to mind, you know, they are icons, and often the circumstances of their death sort of makes them martyrs in a way. But the thing that made them beloved was this sort of retail politics, their connection to their community, their caring about their community. I feel like this is a really good reminder of that.
Yeah, you know, Milk was actually born and raised and came up in New York City. He doesn't move out to San Francisco until 1969. But when he gets there, he wants to help the city, right? Like, yeah. He wants to make the city run better. He's not there necessarily, and we'll get into why he moves into the fight for gay rights, but he really is there to fix the things that are broken. And I think that when you have someone who's deeply invested in that project, especially if you're someone who is suffering from the broken parts of the system, you find a following.
Yeah. You know, politics is always local, but is there anything about this time, the late 70s? I mean, you know, we talk so much about the mid-60s to the mid-70s on this show as a time of national politics. Is there something about the kind of political scene in the late 70s where someone would be really focused in more on the day-to-day of their community?
Yeah, I mean, cities across the United States were in crisis. This is the period when New York City itself was going bankrupt, that there were concerns not just about things like crime rates, which had skyrocketed a decade earlier, but really more so about the economic state of cities and how to make them more livable, how to address issues like poverty, like housing, like childcare. Because cities, thanks to white flight, had lost a lot of their tax base. And so there was this question about how do you sort of rebuild them from the ground up. And that's the project that people like Harvey Milk were engaged in.
Yeah. Which is not to say that he did not champion gay rights issues, and particularly, as we said, towards the end of his career and his life. And it does seem like in 1978, Proposition 6 is one of the big animating moments in his life.
Yeah, Proposition 6 was one of these statewide initiatives that we've talked about before. But in this case, it was aimed at banning gay and lesbian teachers. And this was actually something we'd seen elsewhere in the country as well. In 1977, Anita Bryant in Miami starts Save Our Children, which is this terribly named organization in order to remove employment protection rights for gay men and women in Miami. And so there is this burgeoning national movement to make sure that gay men and women don't have rights. And you see that coming to California in 1978. And it's at that point when there is a real threat to just equal rights for gay people that Harvey Milk really comes forward as the face of gay rights in San Francisco.
And this is playing out at a bunch of different levels, including at the very local level where they're earlier in that year, 1978, Milk had been really instrumental in the passage of a homosexual rights ordinance, considered one of the most progressive in the country. I guess now is where we introduce Dan White into this picture. So Dan White was also a member of the Board of Supervisors. He was the only one, if I gather, to vote against this ordinance. And then shortly thereafter, he resigned his board seat. What is your sense of how much this disagreement over this ordinance around gay rights was a factor in what ended up being a deadly dispute?
So there were a lot of things that were driving Dan White in the late 1970s. I mean, he is coming into conflict increasingly with the other members of the Board of Supervisors because he's becoming more conservative than they are. But he's also like pinched by the fact that he's not making very much money doing this. He had to give up his job as a firefighter, which had been his sort of main source of income. And so he was scraping to get by. And so ultimately he resigns his position. And then no sooner does he resign his position than he's clawing to get it back because he actually has gotten so deeply invested in the fights that he had been fighting. And he doesn't want someone who disagrees with his politics taking his place.
Yeah. And so he develops, you know, a real anger, and both towards Mayor Moscone, but also a little bit towards Milk. And I think Milk had lobbied against not reappointing him. But then on November 27th, he walks into City Hall. He evades the metal detectors. I think he breaks in through a window and then gets into the building. And he walks up to Moscone, shoots him 4 times after they have an argument. And then he runs into Milk. They step into an office and he shoots Milk 5 times. All of this within the Capitol building.
In the Capitol building on a work day, like, there were tons of people around. In between shooting Moscone and Milk, he runs into Dianne Feinstein, who was also a politician in City Hall at the time, and obviously spares her. She's the one who ends up finding Milk's body and ends up announcing to the press later on that the murders happened. And so this is both evidence that he was not taking any precautions. I mean, he was doing this in broad daylight when there were tons of people around, but he was also deliberate, right? He was killing the people who he held responsible for his loss of his inability to regain his seat, and spares people who he doesn't blame.
Yeah. And this might sound naive, or of course, when there's an assassination of a mayor and a local politician, it's going to be a very consequential thing. But it really does seem to just put the entire city of San Francisco into this kind of state of agony. And you read about the moment and the days after, and it just seemed like, I don't know what the way to say it is. It just seemed like a really bad vibe and a bad scene in San Francisco in those days and weeks.
It's a shocking, shocking thing to have happen. I mean, think about, to move us forward in time, think about when Gabby Giffords was shot, her attempted assassination, and how that still sort of is seared in the memory. And as much as it's seared in the national memory, the memory of people in Arizona for whom she was, you know, part of their daily lives in places like Phoenix. It is precisely because they are local people, because they are connected to these communities, that these assassinations, you know, even as they resonate obviously on the national level, on the local level, there's a real sort of pain because the landmark is now marked by this incident.
So as we start to think about the legacy of this story, there's one, which is something that happens at the trial of Dan White, which we'll get to in a minute. But then the other is when Dan White is sentenced, and by to many people seen as receiving a very light sentence, in the wake of that, there are what are called the White Night Riots in San Francisco. And that really seems to be the moment at which Harvey Milk's martyrdom and his political legacy is cemented.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, White is ultimately sentenced to about seven and a half years in prison for murdering two people in broad daylight. He's found guilty of voluntary manslaughter. And this sense that he had been able to just kill a gay man in broad daylight and basically more or less get away with it, that was certainly the felt sense of what had happened in San Francisco at the time, led to these protests by the gay community. And those protests, as seems like in the U.S. almost inevitably happens, lead to a kind of police riot. And that, I think, that unrest that follows what feels to many in the gay community like an acquittal almost is what helps cement this, I think, in the political memory.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the scenes from that day, about 3,000 people were at the peak of this, what was called the White Night Riot, were out in the streets. A couple police cars were lit on fire. Harvey Milk's friends and aides who were at City Hall were apparently trying to sort of bar the doors and stop this from spinning out of control, but people were throwing rocks and other stuff through the front doors of the City Hall building. And there was obviously, as we've been saying, you know, deep anger, frustration with this verdict, a kind of expression of rage for a community that had lost a champion. There was also a particular thing about the trial, and this is where we'll get to kind of one of the other legacies of this story, but there was a particular thing about the trial that people could not get their head around, which is what came to be quickly known and is still known as the so-called Twinkie defense. So lay out how that fits into this whole puzzle.
Sure. So the Twinkie defense, as it becomes known in popular lore, is basically that White had eaten a bunch of Twinkies. He wasn't used to having that much junk food. The sugar spikes in his system. And because he's on this sugar high, that was a mitigating circumstance for the murders that he committed. That's not really what the defense argued, but that's how it gets sort of caricatured in the press. Basically, what the press was arguing was he was deeply, deeply depressed. And here was somebody who ate a regular diet and took care of himself. And one of the symptoms of his depression was that he was just eating junk food all the time, that he had completely lost any sort of connection to his former self because of this depression. So it's actually a more common kind of argument that mental illness and mental distress can be a mitigating circumstance when people commit crimes. But it very quickly becomes this caricature in how we understand both these murders, but also all this like law around murders. And it feeds into this storyline that criminals are coddled and let go for no reason at all.
Yeah. When you read about White and you read about the trial, I mean, he clearly was deeply depressed and troubled. And I think the Twinkie thing, yeah, as you were saying, it was a description of a symptom of a deep depression more than it was a specific defense. That said, the salience of the Twinkie defense through both at the exact moment and through time has just been really remarkable. But at that moment, I mean, even in reports of the White Night Riots, a reporter asked someone who was out in the streets to say, you know, why are you out here? What are you, you know, why are you destroying parts of the city? And they said, well, just tell people that we ate too many Twinkies. This is why we're out here. So, I mean, you know, immediately it becomes this touchstone. I'm wondering, though, if you can talk a little bit about kind of like what is its place, the Twinkie defense, in popular lore? Like, how do people talk about it now? I don't really have my head around it.
I mean, I think it's a lot like the do you know that McDonald's lawsuit where the woman spills hot coffee on herself?
Course.
Yeah. And that's presented as, ugh, Americans are so litigious. You have a little hot coffee spilled on you and all of a sudden you sue for millions of dollars, even though coffee is supposed to be hot. What isn't told in that story, of course, is that it was scalding hot and the woman got serious second and third degree burns because of the scalding that happens to her. And so it's this way that these arguments that we make about the legal system being too soft and too easy to manipulate, those become the stories that we like to tell, and the underlying facts of the case just get completely stripped away.
Yeah, so as we start to wrap up here, I want to come back to Milk himself and his legacy. We talked about how he was focused on local politics, but over the course of his career, he really started to step into his own as a gay rights champion. And there is this famous piece of audio, it's kind of stunning, of him from before his death, but it wasn't released until after his death, in which he talks about his fears of being assassinated because he knew that he was a target. He knew that gay people were targets. And there's also another interview, I think this is the last public on the record interview he gives before he's killed, when he talks about coming out. And he never came out to his mother before she died. And it seems like he wants to encourage others to have the courage and the support to come out to their family and their community in a way that he did not. And so reflecting on how people react when someone comes out, he says, I'm quoting here, he says, "I cannot prevent anyone from getting angry or mad or frustrated. I can only hope that they'll turn that anger and frustration and madness into something positive." He goes on to say, "I hope that gay lawyers and judges and bankers and architects can come out. I hope that every professional gay will say enough, come forward and tell everybody, let the world know. Maybe that will help." So certainly, given the tragedy that follows after, that quote rings so much deeper. But I also think it's important to acknowledge his evolution and the power of coming out, especially at that time. That really leaves a legacy of its own.
I think it's really important. I mean, he doesn't come out publicly. He doesn't publicly identify as gay until he's 40 years old. And he is coming of age in a moment of both gay liberation, but also at a time when coming out was still this incredible political act, because of how little acceptance there was in mainstream straight culture. And so you can see see at this moment in his life, like, he's beginning to move into that gay liberation frame, but he's also working on this very personal level when it comes to coming out, that I think also endears him to a lot of people.
All right, let's leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always for doing this.
Thank you, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of listener-supported, artist-owned shows. It is getting towards the end of the year. If you are in a position to support the things you love this year, you can donate directly to this show through our website, thisdaypod.com. That's also where you can get in touch with any questions or comments about the show, or you can email us, thisdaypod@gmail.com. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
This is to be played only in the event of my death by assassination. I fully realize that hit person who stands for what I stand for, an activist, gay activist, becomes the target or the potential target for somebody who is insecure, terrified, afraid, or very disturbed themselves. I have always considered myself part of a movement, part of a candidacy. I wish I had time to explain everything I did. Almost everything was done in the eyes of the gay movement.
Radiotopia.